In his famous book, La démocratie en Amérique, published in the 1830s, Tocqueville expressed his admiration for the intensity and the quality of democratic life in America. He was amazed by the vitality of voluntary organizations and by the mass involvement of citizens in electoral politics. How different is today's American democracy on the eve of the 2008 presidential election from the one Tocqueville depicted in the 19th century?
Well, of course, Tocqueville is describing a very, very different political system in many ways. First of all, today we have pretty close to universal suffrage for adults. There are some people who can't vote, but basically there are no large restrictions on the right to vote. When Tocqueville was writing, there were 2 million slaves in the country, women could not vote. In other words, the political nation, the electorate, was adult white men. What was democratic about it was that property qualifications had been eliminated, so in almost all the states, so basically all adult white men could vote. But that was still only a portion of the whole population, so it was a much narrower democratic system than we have today. On the other hand, it was much more intense, people's participation in democracy. Politics performed a role in society that today is filled not only by politics, but by entertainment, by movies, by the internet, by sports events. These were major, you know, it was a major form of popular entertainment, involvement, the political leaders were national popular celebrities, Henry Clay, Andrew Jackson, Webster. These were larger than life figures. Now, there's no politician today who had the mass following that those great leaders did. As I say, they're like movie stars and popular singers or something like that. The political party system was far different than today. The parties were much more tightly organized, people identified with the party. Today, the parties are really much less important. You know, Obama and McCain rarely mention what party they're representing. McCain never says he's a Republican. When McCain mentions Republicans, it's to say that he has fought against Republicans and he wants to be, you know, bipartisan. Obama's a Democrat, but you look at the ads, you look at the posters, they don't mention the name of the political party at all. In the 19th century, the political party was the key thing. People were born into a political party, they identify with the political party. Of course, they could change their mind in elections, but the parties were central to American democracy in a way that they aren't today. Voter participation was far higher then than it is now. In 1840, in 1896, you had maybe 80% of the eligible voters coming out to vote. Today, if you get above 50%, people consider that a very high turnout. And in local elections today, 20% is considered okay. So there was much more popular involvement with politics among those who were part of the political nation, which is a much smaller fraction of the whole population than it is today. So it's a somewhat mixed situation.
So there is a widespread judgment that Western countries have entered an era of democratic disenchantment since the 1980s. Many scholars have underlined the loss of legitimacy of elected officials and institutions and the way people tend to distrust their deputies. As an historian of American democracy, do you think it is a new phenomenon? How deep is this so-called crisis of democracy? Or does this presidential campaign reflect a renewed interest in politics?
Well, yes, there has been a disassociation on the part of many people from democracy. I think what's happened since the 80s is two things. One is the ideological demonization of the state. Now, there's always been an anti-statist tradition in America, different from France, let us say, but still with Reagan, or actually not even Reagan, Carter, really, or you could go back further, since the Vietnam War, which convinced many people that the government lies and doesn't tell the truth to the people. Then Nixon with Watergate, where the government was breaking the law and violating the Constitution and the president was evicted from office. Then Carter, who was elected on the grounds that he was not part of the government at all, he was an outsider. Then Reagan, who really developed this comprehensive anti-statist ideology. That has been the dominant ideology of American society since we're still living in the age of Reagan. And Clinton, I think, was sort of a minor league Reagan. I mean, when Clinton said in one of his big speeches, you know, the age of big government is over, he was telling people, I am adopting the basic approach of Reagan, even though I may differ on particular particular issues. So I think we've lived through a generation or two of demonization of the government, which obviously is going to affect the functioning of democracy. Second of all, we've had government after government which just lies to the people. And this, you know, if government has lost its legitimacy, there's reason for it. People don't trust their leaders, whether it's Bush, Clinton, Reagan, Carter, they all lied. We got into wars through lies. We've gotten into, you know, various things. So, you know, there's this separation. People don't trust their elected leaders. There's been all these scandals with, you know, sex scandals, money scandals. So it's understandable that there's a kind of a lack of confidence in democracy. Also, I think the issues confronting American society that are important to people are issues that it doesn't seem like the government has any actual impact on. Globalization, today, financial crisis, it doesn't seem that, or terrorism, you know, it doesn't seem like government is able to really come up with any kind of real solution to these problems. Now, it may be that this presidential campaign does reflect a shift. People are looking more to action by government. We will see. That does seem to be a greater engagement. We will see what the voter turnout is. Everyone is expecting a higher number of people voting this time. Obama has certainly tried to mobilize large numbers of younger voters and others who don't vote, generally speaking. So we will see. You know, it would be nice to have a president who people could feel respect for. We haven't had that in a long time.
When observing the US presidential campaign, a European citizen cannot but be puzzled by the role of money in electoral politics. This time, money seems to favor the Democratic candidate, Barack Obama, who is raising much more funds than his Republican rival, which allows him to compete with stronger means in swing states. Does history provide an explanation for this relatively high tolerance for money as a legitimate tool in American politics?
Well, in a large country like this, money has always been very important. I mean, you know, some people think the great turning point was the election of 1896, where William McKinley and his campaign manager, Mark Hanna, raised enormous sums of money from businessmen in order to fight Bryan, who was the candidate of the populists, the farmers, and really, that was the first really big money election. You know, in the 19th century, the political parties used to finance campaigns, and political office holders basically financed the political party. In the 20th century, with the reform of campaign finance and the decline of the political party, they've had to come to rely more and more on business to fund the campaign. And of course, now with television advertising and the cost and the extreme length of the campaign and the primaries, the cost, as you know, runs into the tens of millions of dollars. And everybody, you know, everybody says it's ridiculous, but nobody does anything about it. I mean, I look at England. I don't know exactly what the situation is in France, but in England, the government dissolves parliament, and 30 days later, there's an election. The whole thing is 30 days. In the United States, the campaigns were going on for 2 years or more. It's absurd. We should try to go to an English system where there's a much shorter campaign period, and then maybe it would cost less. But the problem is now, this either means that the candidates must become beholden to business or look for extremely rich people who can run and finance their own campaign, like the mayor of New York, Bloomberg, or Romney. In other words, well-to-do people who don't have to raise money because they have so much by themselves. But this, of course, this is a serious problem for democracy, that nothing can happen without immense amounts of money behind it.
Barack Obama's campaign and his possible election as President of the United States of America seem to mark a turning point in the history of race relations in America. What has been the role of race in the shaping of American democracy since the 19th century? And does the memory of slavery, for instance, still play a role in contemporary politics?
Well, I think anybody who knows something about American history will see the election of Obama, if he is elected, as a major, major turning point in American race relations. I don't care if you like Obama, you prefer McCain. It is astonishing in the long trajectory of American history that a black man may be elected president of the United States. You know, in the entire history of the United States, there have been three black governors of states. No, four actually, four black governors of states. All of American history, there have been only five black members of the U.S. Senate. So the barriers to blacks getting offices where you need a lot of white votes have been enormous. There have been black members of Congress, but that's because they represent black districts. But when you get to the Senate, to governor, to you know, president, you basically it's white votes that are going to determine it. So, you know, race is a high barrier. I think Obama has succeeded partly because he does project what they call a post-racial image. He's not running as a black candidate. He never mentions the fact that he's a black candidate. And he doesn't emphasize traditional black issues. He's not running as what they call a race man. But in the, you know, there have been other black politicians like that in the past who want to move beyond race. But certainly, I think race has always shaped American democracy. Certainly since the Civil Rights Movement, race has been one of the major strong points of the Republican Party. Richard Nixon originated what they call the Southern Strategy, for the Republicans to play upon white resentment over the Civil Rights Movement. The South, as you know, used to be solidly Democratic. After Civil Rights, it shifted over to being solidly Republican, although Obama is now making inroads. And so race has always been a key dividing line in American politics. And I think the Obama campaign, whatever the result, is an important step toward maybe a society where race is not quite as divisive as it has been in our history.
During the Democratic primary, it was sometimes assumed that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton embodied two groups, blacks and women, that were formerly excluded from democratic participation and whose interests were at odds rather than converging. What has been the relationship between movements promoting black men's political rights and those in favor of women's right to vote in the history of American democracy?
You could write a long book about this. Here's the complicated story. I mean, because the movement for women's rights arose out of the abolitionist movement. The movement to abolish slavery, as one person said before the Civil War, was the school of rights for all Americans. The early women's movement learned the language of rights and the organizational tactics from the abolitionists, and they worked together. After the Civil War, there was a split. When black men were given the right to vote, but white women still didn't have it, some of the women's movement moved off into their own direction because they thought they had been betrayed by the abolitionists. Later on, in order to get the right to vote for women, they acquiesced in the disenfranchisement of blacks. I mean, blacks had the right to vote taken away around the turn of the century. When women got the right to vote in 1920, it was only because they had basically agreed that it wouldn't affect black women in the South, that black women would still be, blacks would still be disenfranchised in the South. So there have been tensions between these movements over the years. On the other hand, since the New Deal, the Democratic Party has been the home of both women activists and black voters. And probably they have cooperated more often than they've been at odds. There have been certain tensions. I think many black political leaders are not sympathetic to the women's movement in a way. They have a machismo kind of attitude toward things. Many blacks are very conservative on issues like gay rights, women's rights. But, you know, a black friend once, you know, if the Republicans weren't so obviously racist in many ways, on social issues they might win more black votes. But I think, you know, I think this split was grossly exaggerated during the primaries. Hillary certainly represented women, and Obama got the black vote. But there's no necessary conflict at all between these two movements. And in fact, there's a lot of overlap. And I think, you know, under an Obama presidency, I think it will be there will be great gains made for women, especially compared to what's happened under Bush.
It is often said that Americans are, by nature, distrustful of the state. Is this idea a political myth or a genuine peculiarity of American democracy? To what extent do the recent calls for more regulation in the financial market and for state intervention challenge the predominance of free market ideologies in American politics?
Many Americans are distrustful of the state, but I think to say this is a general rule of all of American history is not really correct. There certainly have been strong movements and periods where the state was brought in, the Progressive Era, the New Deal, the Great Society. Black people have always looked to the state, the national state, to protect them against local violence and local discrimination. Whether it was Lincoln emancipating the slaves or the civil rights movement of the 60s, looked to a powerful national state to protect people's rights. I think when people find there's a crisis, they turn to the state. One of the many, many mistakes and crimes and errors of the Bush administration was after September 11th, people kind of wanted to, in a sense, cooperate or look to the state and to the community as a point of unity, and the Bush administration was incapable of doing anything with that because of its free market ideology. You know, Bush, when people wanted to have a sense of collective action and collective identity, and all Bush said was, well, go shopping, that'll help the society, you know. Today, of course, in a financial crisis, people are again looking to the state. All these rich guys who never wanted to be regulated are suddenly going hat in hand and begging for taxpayers' money. So one hopes that we will see a movement away from the extreme deregulation, which has gotten us into this mess, and toward a more balanced kind of situation, which might not be all that different from France, Britain, or many European countries, actually.
Economic issues seem to hold sway over the presidential campaign's debates. The question of economic security that had been overlooked in American politics for a very long time seems to be revived by the financial crisis. What have been the significance and the role of economic democracy in the general history of American democracy?
Well, again, I think, you know, Americans have a very complex set of definitions of economic democracy and economic freedom. On the one hand, there is this strong laissez-faire tradition and free market, free competition. On the other hand, there's another long tradition of economic security, that there should not be a level beneath which people should sink. People look, even today, polls show people think the government should guarantee jobs for those who don't have them, should help people keep their homes. You know, we're not, even though the government seems like that, we are not a society of just pure dog-eat-dog, intense competition, every man for himself. Public views generally do think that the government has a economic responsibility to help people pursue their economic interests, in other words, and not fall below a certain level. But the relation between economic and political democracy is a very complex and difficult one in American history, which has never been solved. People want individual initiative, they want individual freedom, but they also want economic security. And these cut against each other in some ways. But I think, yes, again, today, people are looking to the government to help them when their homes, they're in danger of losing their homes, they're in danger of losing their bank accounts, they're in danger of losing their retirement accounts. They are turning to the government to help them. And the government does appear to be the guarantor of last resort of people's economic security. Now, how this will work out, I don't know. If McCain is elected, I think nothing will happen. If Obama's elected, we may see a significant shift toward a more active government role in this than we have seen in the last generation.
Political discourses reflect how societies view and represent themselves. It is striking that both candidates to the presidential election speak on behalf of the middle class, or, as they say, of Main Street, as opposed to Wall Street. However, they seem to pay little attention to the representation of working and poor people, or to issues of labor relations and economic inequalities. How can we explain this apparent lack of interest for the questions of poverty, redistribution, and equality in the political debate?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's quite accurate about this campaign. you know, there is an assumption that the mass of the electorate is middle class, that if you appeal to the middle class, that's how to win the election. And there's also, most Americans define themselves as middle class. Very rich people talk of themselves as middle class. Poor people talk of themselves as middle class. If you ask Americans, 80% of them are middle class. On the other hand, if you look at the class structure, 80% are not middle class. There's a much larger number of the poor, of working class people, and of course, rich. You know, there's a very large middle class in this country, but it's not as large as people think it is. But the general political wisdom is, this is how you have to talk, you know, and that if you talk about the poor, you talk about labor, it's very striking. Obama, the candidate of the Democratic Party, never mentions the word labor union, you know, that kind of thing. Then you are accused of fomenting class conflict, and middle class people, suburban people, the swing voters, get frightened by that. Whereas if you talk about Main Street middle class, then you can appeal to this broad section of the electorate. I don't know that this is really true, but this seems to be the wisdom accepted by both parties. It's generally assumed that poor people do not vote and cannot be gotten to vote. You know, some people say, well, look, only half the electorate votes. A lot of the people who don't vote are the poor. Why don't we say something and get them out to vote? But they're not willing to risk that. They're not willing to risk frightening the middle class by appealing on a very, you know, in a strong, direct way to working class voters. But still, a lot of what they're really talking about are working class people, people who can't afford health insurance, people whose jobs are in danger, people who are finding manufacturing moving abroad. So they are talking about issues of class without really using the language of class.
Both candidates proclaim their attachment to the defense of American freedom. However, as you've shown in the story of American freedom in 1998, this concept has always had various meanings and has been the subject of intense debates and conflicts since the American Revolution. To which traditions of American freedom do Obama and McCain's ideologies belong?
That's interesting. I think McCain is very much in the modern Republican Reagan tradition of freedom, which is very much limited government, laissez-faire, free competition, anti-communism, although that's not really an issue at the moment, strong military, and really distrust of government. I think McCain is a very accurate reflector of and limited regulation on all fronts, environmental, etc., with an overlay of this social conservatism, which then, even though they're against big government, they want the government to regulate your private moral behavior, homosexuality, abortion rights, that kind of thing. This is very much the Reagan tradition, which has become the dominant view in many ways in American politics. Obama is a complicated combination of traditional democratic notions of freedom, which tend to have a greater emphasis on equality, on government action, on security, but still not really, but still with an overlay of this Reagan approach of limited government, of not, of emphasizing private individual, private initiative, voluntary. But Obama also, despite the fact that he doesn't talk about race, Obama does also come out of a black tradition. It's a tradition of the great black abolitionist Frederick Douglass. It's a tradition of trying to think of economic policies that will help move the country beyond race. That the notion of freedom is one, is a society where race no longer matters, but it no longer matters not because people are just sweeping it under the rug and ignoring it, but because you actually have greater opportunity and equality. That's a tradition of black politics, even though Obama does not claim that tradition. He doesn't say, I'm in the black political tradition. I think he is, in a way. It's a tradition of Martin Luther King. The notion of going beyond race in some way in a more equal society as the essence of American freedom. I think Obama does fit into that category.
And last question. Liberalism has been continuously weak in U.S. politics since the 1970s. Isn't it a paradoxical effect of George Bush's presidency that its excessively conservative-oriented decisions now seem to favor a reawakening of liberalism.
Well, you know, the great historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. wrote this book some years ago, The Cycles of American History, in which he just said there's a sort of pendulum swing, conservatism, liberalism, or state, non-state. He kept waiting for the reawakening of liberalism to happen, but he died last year and it hadn't happened. It may be happening, but of course it's coming under a new name. Obama does not talk about liberalism. He doesn't say, I'm a liberal. As far as I can see, there's only one leading politician in this country who can say, who says, I am a liberal, and that's the mayor of New York, Bloomberg. When he ran last time, he said, I'm a liberal, I'm proud to be a liberal. He's so rich, he can say anything he wants. And New York is a liberal city. So it's liberalism without the name liberalism. They call it progressive now, or they don't even give it a name, what his philosophy is. But you're right, it includes many aspects of traditional liberalism. But the liberalism that came out of the 60s, not the 1930s, Obama's liberal, you know, it's the liberalism of some interest in economic equality, but mostly personal freedom. And that's why he's against laws banning abortion, and he's in favor of the rights of gays, and he's in favor of blacks achieving equality. It's the liberalism which says, let's get rid of these artificial barriers. But it's not the liberalism of economic radicalism, economic redistribution, labor, the New Deal liberalism. That is really gone from both parties at the moment as a coherent ideology. But, you know, we're in the 21st century. Obama's liberalism is, whatever it's called, is for the modern world, and it's not, you know, of an era when, because after all, labor is only, you know, how many, labor is a minor feature of American, labor unions are a minor feature of American life now. They used to be a powerful feature, and so unless the labor movement revives, you're not going to see that labor-infused liberalism be a dominant force in the politics again.
Thank you very much.